Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The owners of sports teams are spending billions on over-the-top, glitzy stadiums. Sometimes they make the public pay for them, too, with tax dollars. San Diego said no, so the San Diego Chargers are moving to Los Angeles. It's all part of the larger trend of teams moving and upgrading their stadiums to make more money. Billions more. This hour on Point, paying to play. Who benefits? And who should foot the bill? You can join the conversation on air or online. Did your team move to another city for a better stadium? Did you get a team? Who should pay for it? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we're talking about the NFL playoffs and making our Super Bowl predictions. But first, joining me from New York is Ken Belson, national NFL reporter for The New York Times. Ken, great to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So big news this week, the San Diego Chargers announcing they're moving to Los Angeles. Tell us why'd they go.
The team tried for about a dozen years to get a new stadium to replace the place they're playing now, which is one of the oldest and perhaps most beat-up stadiums in the NFL. And they had a ballot measure in November. It was soundly defeated. Had they succeeded, they would have received several hundred million dollars in hotel taxes to help them build a new stadium downtown. The voters basically said no thank you, and they had an option to move to Los Angeles, to move into a much larger, bigger moneymaker in Los Angeles, and so they exercised that option, and they are leaving town after more than a half a century.
Here's an interview with ESPN last week. Chargers owner Jeff Spanos said he chose to move the team because he couldn't get public funding, as you say, to build a new stadium in San Diego.
After 15 years of working hard trying to get something in San Diego, and more, I guess, looking at last year's initiative, the low turnout for support, I think we only received 43%. It's just very difficult to get something done with any type of public subsidy in San Diego.
And here's Steve Johnson, a Chargers fan, fighting back tears after he dropped off an armful of Chargers gear in front of team headquarters last week. The team announced it will be moving to Los Angeles, of course. And after 50 years of supporting this team, Steve said, I'm done.
I'm brokenhearted. This team is part of my family. This has been part of my family for 50 years, and I'm out of here. I'm done.
Team's been in San Diego, Ken, for what, 60 years? Of course these fans feel jilted, right?
Yes, I don't blame them. They've put emotional capital into the team. They've paid a lot of money for season tickets and merchandise and so forth that have made the team wealthy. San Diego Chargers are not one of the most wealthy teams by NFL standards, but nobody loses money in the NFL because the TV money is so large and the merchandising deals and the sponsorship deals are so large. So it's hard to feel bad for an owner who, is already making money but is not making yet more money.
Mm-hmm. The Chargers will ultimately play in the same arena as the Los Angeles Rams, who themselves moved from St. Louis last year. That arena is a $2.6 billion sports palace. Tell us about that, Ken Belson.
Stan Kroenke, the owner of the Rams in St. Louis, wanted to leave. What was different there is that St. Louis actually came up with a plan for a new stadium that would cost Stan Kroenke very little money, and he turned it down anyway, and the owners decided that they would approve his application to go to L.A. because in the grander scheme of things, it was better to have a team in Los Angeles, a much wealthier and larger market, than St. Louis, which is a much smaller market. And so he was allowed to abandon his fans of more than 20 years. Because the greater good of the NFL would be to have a team back in Los Angeles and a big stadium at $2.6 billion that is likely to increase the value of all the NFL teams, not just Stan Kroenke's.
So it's a $2.6 billion stadium in Inglewood, right? It will have 80,000 seats, as well as retail and residential districts. Here's Stan Kroenke, the owner, telling CBS Los Angeles about his hopes for the stadium.
I have an opportunity to deliver an iconic, really iconic, world-class stadium building for the region, which is filled with unlimited opportunities.
So L.A. is a big place, Ken Belson. Is there a fan base big enough for two big teams to fill those huge stadium?
Some owners actually doubt this. There were several owners who voted against a proposal last year that would have had the Chargers and the Raiders from Oakland moving there together because they didn't believe the NFL could have two teams in Los Angeles both be successful. And frankly, this year with the Rams returning for the first time in a long time, they had a very mixed reaction. Fans were initially very supportive. The team didn't do well. Ratings, television ratings were not very good or spotty, I should say. And so there's a lot of disappointment. Yes, Los Angeles is a very crowded market, so it's big, but there are a lot of competition. There's the Lakers and the Dodgers, and there's two very big college football teams, UCLA and USC, plus other smaller ones. So it's not as if fans don't have other things to do. And frankly, LA was thriving without the NFL, and so I think fans have made up their mind to root for other teams, the Packers, the Cowboys, or the Raiders.
Talk about the larger trend surrounding NFL teams relocating and the financial incentives or rewards for the National Football League when a team, in fact, relocates.
Well, it's sort of built into the finances of the league. The owners can get several hundred million dollars in low-cost financing from the other owners. They've set up a kind of stadium fund to do this. But the condition for it is that there's a, quote, public-private partnership. So it behooves the owner to get this low-cost financing to go out and twist the arm of a municipality to help contribute to that. And so they're contingent. And as a consequence, it's not a surprise that owners go out and try and get some subsidies from the local governments because that allows them to fill in the pieces of their financial puzzle through the NFL as well. Then they go and ask the fans to pay up as well through personal seat licenses. There are naming rights, which are worth sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on the city. And then there's some other financing that the team often has to cobble together. But that's often a very small piece of the overall puzzle. So when you put together the public portion, the NFL financing, asking the fans for money, sponsorships, and so forth, the share that the owner actually puts up is relatively small or shrinking. One thing that should be said is that these football stadiums are getting larger or more expensive and more expensive. And part of the reason for that is that, again, built into the NFL revenue sharing agreements, the owners of these big stadiums get to keep the revenue entirely for themselves from the luxury boxes and the suites and the premium seats. And so these stadiums that maybe 70,000 seats, 80,000 seats, a good 10, 20, even 30,000 of those seats will be in what's considered sort of premium areas, and the owners will keep all of that money. They won't share them with the other teams. So again, it behooves the owners to build very glitzy places, not just stadiums for people to watch football in.
So I want to ask you more about that because NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell has pledged that the NFL would hit $25 billion in revenue by 2027. They are worth $13 billion today. And I want to talk about the revenue goals as it relates to all this. Here's some sound, an interview with Bloomberg's David Westin in April, where NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell confirmed that he wants the league and the games to reach their largest possible audience.
We're not going to just try to get to a number. We want to grow the NFL, and that includes on a global basis. We believe that international is a great opportunity for us to expand our game. We're playing in London. We're playing in Mexico this year. We have plans to play in China in the near future. So we want to continue to bring our game to the broadest audience around the globe.
So the revenue goals for the NFL are a big part of this, Ken. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think that's sort of the overarching theme is that you know, like a company that keeps growing through mergers and acquisitions, the NFL wants to be not just the biggest, but much bigger. And to grow and reach that target of $25 billion, although the commissioner seemed to want to step back a little bit from that hard number, they have to add about $1 billion in revenue a year. Building big stadiums in places like Los Angeles automatically helped do that. It raises the value of all the other teams, too. The value of Stan Kroenke's team, the Rams, doubled before they even took the field in Los Angeles. So all boats in this case rise.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of hiccups, potential hiccups, one of which is television ratings. This assumes television, the value of these television contracts that CBS, NBC, and others pay will keep growing at the same rate they have.
Right, because ratings have been going down, Ken, right?
This year they slipped at all of the major broadcasters for the first time that's ever happened, that every one of the broadcasters saw a decline. And that is potentially worrisome. Some of that may have been related to the publicity around the presidential elections, but there's other people worried that younger fans, anyway, aren't tuning in. They're watching on Twitter, they're watching on the internet and other places. So they're not necessarily sitting in a traditional living room with a sofa and a remote control the way the parents did. And that suggests that although the total number of viewers may be the same, they may not be watching in the same way. And CBS may say in the future, well, if that's the case, we aren't selling as many ads or reaching as many eyeballs. We don't want to pay as much. So this could be a big bump in the road for them.
So you talk about all boats rise with regard to the value of the teams. You know, what does it do to the fans, Ken Bilson? I mean, you've got these big glitzy stadiums, billion-dollar stadiums, fancy boxes where I suppose ticket prices are in the thousands. I mean, what does it do to regular folks who just want to go to a football game with their kid?
Yeah, I hear this at stadiums everywhere that I go, is that fans feel alienated. They feel priced out. This is not a new phenomenon. You see it in basketball arenas now where, for instance, the New York Knicks have courtside seats for several thousand dollars. You know, the stadiums that I went to as a kid for a couple of bucks to sit in the upper deck eating my sandwich, watching a baseball game, mm-hmm. they're long gone. There's a sop to that. Most owners will have small sections of relatively inexpensive seats, but the key word is relatively inexpensive. Even those, it's hard to get a family of four to a pro stadium cheaply these days.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the sky-high cost of professional sports stadiums this hour and who should pay for them. The San Diego Chargers just announced a move to Los Angeles because residents wouldn't pay. I got to get this in here. During an introductory press conference for the Chargers yesterday, L.A. Chargers head coach Anthony Lynn mistakenly called the team the San Diego Chargers.
Folks, I am pumped. I am so proud to be the head coach for the L.A. Chargers. Oops.
Oops. You can join the conversation. Do stadiums need to be sports palaces with fancy food courts to get you in the door for a game? Can you afford tickets even without the stadium upgrades? We're speaking this hour with Ken Bilson, national NFL reporter for The New York Times. And now joining me from Northampton, Massachusetts, is Andrew Zimbalist, sports economist at Smith College. He's author of Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup, and Unwinding Madness, What Went Wrong with College Sports and How to Fix It. Andrew, great to have you. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
So help us understand the effect of sports teams on local economies. Does public investment in a stadium benefit local economies?
Generally speaking, no. Of course, as in most things, the devil is in the details. So one couldn't say that building an office building on Wall Street would have the same effect on New York City as building an office building in Providence, Rhode Island. So you have to understand a good deal about the local economy. But the statistical or econometric work that has been done by scholars over the last 30 years basically finds that a stadium or an arena by itself does not promote local economic development. One has to look at the details, though. Is it a stadium or arena that's financed 100% by the public, or 50% or 0% by the public? How much land is being used? What's contiguous to that land? What the deal is in terms of, mm-hmm. of rent or revenue sharing or property taxes? But as a general matter, a stadium by itself is not a promoter of economic development.
So since 2000, more than 45 sports stadiums were either built or renovated. created. And I'm curious, of those, how many were built with public funding, and has that shifted over time?
You know, it's a strange number to try to put together for a number of reasons, because it's affected by the latest deals, by outliers a great deal. It also covers up some hidden subsidies that occur. But basically, we're more or less steady at around 60% of financing comes from public sources.
Mm-hmm. And so of those that come from public sources, what's so interesting to me is when local and state governments agree to pony up that money for these stadiums, taxpayers are on the hook for years, sometimes even after the team leaves town, right?
That's correct. But let's take a look at that a little bit more closely. Let's say that some public authority, some public government has agreed to cover $500 million out of a $1 billion stadium. That $500 million will be handled primarily properly by a bond. The bond would be a $500 million bond, probably with principal and interest costs, a total debt service of about $30 million a year. And if the local population is $2.5 million, that's $12 per head. So if you go out and you ask people in this city, is it worth $12 to you every year to have an NFL team in your town? Would you be willing to pay for that? And you can get more than usually 50% of the people saying, yeah, that's fine with me. It's not presented to them that there are alternative ways to use that $12 per head or $30 million a year. Maybe mm-hmm. maybe you can upgrade the schools. Maybe you can give the teachers decent salaries. But when it's presented by itself, the NFL and the other professional sports in this country are sufficiently popular, people generally will go along with that.
Mm. Let me bring another voice in here. Joining me from Los Angeles is Thomas Bateman, a lifelong Rams fan who managed a Facebook page dedicated to bringing the Rams back to Los Angeles. He spent 6 years growing public support for the Rams moving back to L.A. Thomas, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jane.
So 7 years spearheading this movement to bring the Rams back to L.A. Why'd you do it?
Being a Rams fan, was something I grew up on, and it never left. Even though the team had moved to St. Louis, it was always still there. Even if I wasn't actively cheering for the team, it was still always there. So when the possibility came out that the Rams might possibly move back, I jumped on it. That mm-hmm. kind of rekindled my interest.
So do people want the Rams back in L.A.?
Well, certainly there are a lot of people that did want it. But it took time to kind of grow it, because it was always like reaching back and remembering a fond memory, and that's the thing that rekindled in a lot of people that we could have the Rams back.
What about the folks back in St. Louis? Don't you feel for them a little bit? They lost their team.
Well, I think yeah, because we underwent that back in 1995 when the team was ripped away from us. So I do have some sympathy. But they were my team first.
A little bit of payback is what you're saying there, okay?
I try not to get too personal about it, but when it comes down to it, it was my team first before it was theirs.
What do you think about all this big money, Tom Bateman? Does it seem like these massive stadiums, these billion-dollar teams, are they really serving the fans, or is it mostly just the wealthy owners and the NFL that are benefiting from this?
Well, I think it's a case of both. But let's be honest, the NFL is a business, and these big stadiums, that's the cost of doing business, and it kind of goes beyond simply the fans. I mean, I think fans do get a lot out of it. However, we have to understand that it's all a business. We know that the Rams moving back to Los Angeles, that was a business decision more than it was a fan decision.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, enjoy your new Los Angeles Rams. Tom Bateman joining me from Los Angeles. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's get some callers in here. Many on the line waiting. William first in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, William. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I have somewhat of a unique perspective on all of this, having lived in Los Angeles for a long time, and now I live in Atlanta. And when we didn't have pro football in Los Angeles, we did fine. There was no loss of civic identity. And now I've been in Atlanta for 6 years, and they're tearing down the old stadium to build a new stadium at a cost of approximately $1.5 billion. And if you look at the neighborhood around the stadium, it's just devastated. Mm. And it's just deplorable to me that we would waste that kind of money on a facility that's used maybe 15 days a year when there's so much obvious need in the community.
William, thank you very much for the call. It's an interesting point, Andrew Zimbalist. I mean, the utilization rate of these stadiums is very low. I mean, 8 to 10 home games a year, maybe a few concerts in the mix. But there you go.
That's right. We still have 365 days a year. And you're talking about 15 to 20 days that the stadium will be used. We're talking about, generally speaking, outdoor facilities that hold 70 or 80,000. So typical concerts don't really make sense there. And you're, you know, the footprint of a stadium is usually in the neighborhood of 10 to 14 acres. Plus, with the tailgating culture that surrounds professional football anyway, you might be talking about another 20 or 30 acres around that.
Mm-hmm.
So you plunk that down in the middle of a neighborhood, and that large amount of land, of acreage, is going to be dark 345 days out of the year. That's not good for it's not good for retail. It's not good for anything.
Ken Belson, William brought up the neighborhoods surrounding these stadiums, and you've written about the chasm between the rich and the poor, as exemplified specifically by the Atlanta Falcons' new stadium, built right in the middle of one of the poorest neighborhoods in that region.
Yes, I kind of road tested the team's commitment. Unusually, I suppose, for an NFL owner, Arthur Blank, who owns the Falcons and the soccer team that will be playing in that new stadium, has devoted a lot of his philanthropy to fixing up this neighborhood. And while that's to be applauded, I think a lot of the neighbors, and there's about 6,000 people who live in these two adjoining neighborhoods, smell gentrification. And they see $1.5 billion going into a stadium, $200 million of that money comes from the city in the form of hotel taxes. And as one local politician told me, if they devoted $200 million to our neighborhood, I wouldn't be complaining. But that's not what's happening. There's significant flooding in that neighborhood. It's a neighborhood overtaken by heroin traffickers. I did a police ride along there at night. 42% of the homes or the plots of land in that neighborhood are either abandoned or abandoned homes. So it is a pretty stark reminder of the wealthy and the poor, literally side by side. And so, you know, you could point to the trickle-down effect of stadiums, the civic pride, the visitors who might come from out of town for a game. But very little of that is actually reaching this neighborhood literally across the street.
Let me bring another voice in here from Oklahoma City, State Senator David Holt. He was Mayor Mick Cornett's assistant when Cornett struck the deal to bring the former Seattle Supersonics to Oklahoma City in 2008. He wrote a book called Big League City, Oklahoma City's Rise to the NBA, which chronicles how the team was brought to Oklahoma City. David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
Well, thank you. I want to play some sound here. These are fans of the Seattle Supersonics protesting the franchise's departure at its final home game back in 2008. The team then, of course, moved to Oklahoma City last year and became the Thunder. David, give us a sense of what Oklahoma City was like before the Thunder came.
Sure. Well, I grew up here in the 1980s, and I kind of describe it as an alternate universe outside of American pop culture. You know, if you grew up here in the 80s, you were in a city of a million people that was, you know, had clean air, clean water, no traffic, you know, a low cost of living, but, you know, nothing ever happened here. And so we were sort of hemorrhaging young people, you know, to Dallas, to Houston, for the more adventurous, maybe to the coast. But we really needed something here like the Thunder, like the NBA. Mm-hmm. And I think we didn't really even dream that we could get it. However, we went ahead and made an investment in a vacuum. You know, in contrast to some of the conversations you've been having over the last 30 minutes about negotiations with sports teams, our voters went to the polls in 1993 and approved a sports arena with absolutely no prospects for getting a team. And so we went ahead and built the sports arena in the early 2000s. Debt-free, I should add, and approved by the voters. So a little bit different than some of the different cases that you've talked about today.
Right. So people in Oklahoma City wanted this team. Financing was done. What's been the impact then on your community?
Well, we think that it's been a total game changer for us. You know, as your economist was mentioning at the beginning of his remarks, you know, when he talked about Providence, well, we're Providence, you know, in this story. You know, we're Oklahoma City. We had never had a major league sports team. And a major league sports team in American life is about as close as this country has to bestowing a blue ribbon on major cities. And so, of course, it's been great for civic pride, and it's been great for, you know, the economy downtown on game nights. But what it's really affected is the way we perceive ourselves and the way the nation perceives us. And we think the world. I mean, our Thunder have brought the name Oklahoma City to people all around the globe. And we think that's made a real difference in millennial growth here in Oklahoma City. We think it's made a difference in economic growth. I think you will find that most people in Oklahoma City are very happy with the investment that they made in our sports arena.
What do you make of the big money, the billions and billions of dollars being spent publicly, privately, by owners, benefiting the, you know, the NFL, the NBA, whatever it may be? What do you make of all that?
Well, I mean, I think as long as the ownership groups are generous back to the community, and I think that our ownership group here in Oklahoma City, led by Clay Bennett, has been very generous, and the players have been very generous, and I think there's been a very passionate relationship between the team and the city. And I don't think that here in Oklahoma City that we're at all resentful of any financial success enjoyed by the team, because they have shared that success with us.
Mm. Sounds like it's working well for you. Thank you very much, David Hope Holt, joining us from Oklahoma City. Good luck to you, David. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Let's go to more calls here. Brian in Boston, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
So I basically had a question about basically when a team moves, they have to get approval by the ownership of all the other teams in the NFL. And obviously, money is probably in the forefront. And isn't it a conflict of interest for the fan bases in these areas to have the decision being made by owners in other markets, pulling a team away from diehard fans that have been fans for 50, 60 years, you know, if not longer, you know, and these decisions being made about profit by somebody on another coast?
It's an interesting and great point, Brian. Thank you. Ken Belson, will you take that?
Sure. I mean, the NFL, like any of these major leagues, is a partnership. There are 32 shareholders, one vote for each team. The fans are customers. They're not shareholders. Sometimes they're generously called stakeholders. But at the end of the day, it's a closed community of rather wealthy people making decisions about their own properties. And fans be damned sometimes. I don't think they make these decisions lightly. I think there's a lot of owners, particularly the owners who have had teams in their families for many generations. I think of the Pittsburgh Steelers, for instance, the New York Giants, mm-hmm. Where you have multi-generational owners. I don't think they like moving teams. But you have a lot of new owners who have bought into the league in the last 10, 15 years who have paid hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars for their teams and want a return on their investment. And so for them, abandoning fans in St. Louis for a wealthier market like Los Angeles helps them pay back their investment and, in theory, could help them remain in their own markets. I think of the owner, for instance, of the Buffalo Bills, who paid a then-record $1.4 billion for his team. He probably wants to keep his team in Buffalo. The faster he's able to pay back his own investment in that team, the more likely he is to keep the team around.
Can I just add there that there's another element, which is that owners have in the past, in many cases, voted against. And you need a three-quarter approval, not 100% approval of the other owners. But in many cases, they voted against allowing teams to move because they wanted teams to remain committed to the neighborhoods and the cities that have supported them. But it's also true that, and there have been, by the way, antitrust litigations around that. More recently, the NFL says, okay, you can move, but you have to give us a relocation fee. So it's likely that Dean Spanos at the Chargers is going to have to pay somewhere in the order of $500 million in order to get permission from the NFL to move. So not only does the move presumably raise the revenue that is generated by the Chargers year in and year out, but it also gives $500 million or more to the other owners to split amongst themselves as a relocation fee.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the cost of professional sports stadiums this hour and what it means for a team to relocate to a new city when its fan base is left behind. You can join the conversation. Colts fans, will you ever get over the move from Baltimore to Indianapolis? How about the Supersonics move to Oklahoma City? What does it mean for civic pride and engagement when teams are lured away to other cities with better stadiums? I want to play some tape here. In March of 1984, the Baltimore Colts packed up Mayflower moving fans and vans and left for Indianapolis in the dark of night. The team relocated after it failed to reach a deal with the city. Here is Mayor William Donald Schaefer telling a local news station that he has to retain what little dignity he has left after the team went.
I'm trying to retain what little dignity I have left in this matter. Second, if the Colts had to sneak out of town at night, it degrades a great tradition of the city in football.
In 1998, New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft said he was moving the Patriots to Hartford, Connecticut. Then Governor John Rowland promised to build a $350 million stadium for the team. It fell apart when Kraft pulled the plug on the deal, citing delays in construction. He was also able to get the state of Massachusetts to contribute $70 million to renovations at Foxborough. Here he is at that 1998 press conference.
In these negotiations, we have tried to protect our fan interest. We will, unfortunately, we don't have luxury suites and club seats at Foxborough from the corporate community where they can support us. This stadium will allow us to do that so we can keep the general seating very moderately priced. And those are the fans who stay with us in the tough times as well as the good times.
We're speaking this hour with Ken Belson, national NFL reporter for The New York Times, and Andrew Zimblist, sports economist at Smith College. I hear Robert Kraft there, Andrew Zimblist, and I'm also looking at pictures here of the Atlanta Falcons' new home, a $1.5 billion palace, got 30-story high retractable roof shaped like petals. It's got the NFL's largest video board, enormous windows that face the Atlanta skyline. It sounds amazing, but I'm just curious what the ripple effect is of all of this, of a publicly, privately funded stadium. What does it mean for smaller cities that don't have the leverage than an Atlanta or a Boston or whatever may have?
Okay, so a few things. First of all, on the $70 million that Robert Kraft got the state to contribute to the construction of the new stadium in Foxborough, Gillette Stadium, that was all paid back. And so Kraft deserves some credit here because in some cases, and Foxborough is one of them, the owner has put up the entire bill, the entire cost for building the stadium.
Himself,
yeah. In terms of Atlanta, let me just tell the listeners that there's a wonderful article by Ken Belson last week in the New York Times, which I suggest everybody take a look at. In terms of small cities getting major sports teams, yeah, they're not going to. They're not going to both because they can't afford to put up hundreds of millions of dollars to aid in the construction financing, but because owners don't want to be in small cities. They want to be in large cities with lots of big corporations and lots of rich people so that they can get corporate sponsorships and signage money and fill their luxury boxes and get catering revenue. So small cities are out of the picture, but I'm not so sure that we should feel that badly for them. Small cities have residents who can still watch football and baseball and basketball and hockey and soccer on television. And if they want to, those people can travel to the big cities to see the games in person.
Ken Belson, do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other sort of underlying factor, certainly with the NFL, is the amount of money, the vast majority of their money they make is actually from television contracts. It's shared amongst all the teams. And so you have to factor in the networks, and they would, of course, like to reach the most number of viewers in the biggest cities. And so they don't necessarily want the NFL in, you know, Iowa or South Dakota. Mm. It's not going to get their games broadcast with the same avidity. The one exception is Green Bay. It's kind of a legacy case. There'll never be another team allowed to be owned municipally. But they're kind of a throwback, and nobody wants to get rid of them. And for the purposes of counting eyeballs on television, they're considered part of Milwaukee anyway. So, yeah, I mean, the NFL has lots of incentives, all the major leagues do, to remain in the biggest cities possible. It's interesting, I found, and Andrew, tell me if you agree, it's often the smallest cities that try and pony up the most for the teams, maybe because they're the most desperate. You look at the money that was poured into the Superdome in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. The voters in or the politicians in St. Louis were about to lose their team and were eager to help build a $1.2 billion stadium there to keep the Rams, whereas Los Angeles actually isn't putting up a ton of money. The Mets and Yankees in New York didn't the city of New York didn't contribute a vast sum considering the size of those stadiums. And then, as we pointed out, Robert Kraft largely financed his own stadium in Massachusetts.
Right. Yeah. That's right. So this is in part a linguistic question here, because what do we mean by small? If by small you mean 2 million, 3 million people living in the city or 1.5 million people, yes, those cities, in order to attract an owner to come to them, have to give them more in terms of public support. But if you're talking small in terms of 300,000, 500,000, those cities are never going to get, with the exception of Green Bay, going to get a major league team.
Let me jump in here and go to Oklahoma City again. Nathan is on the line. Hi, Nathan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Gene. I know you're short on time. Just wanted to share a quick story from Detroit, what they're doing with their stadium.
Okay.
Detroit has a lot of rundown areas that aren't generating any revenue. It's all abandoned buildings, and they don't even have the money to bulldoze them to revitalize them. And one by one, football, baseball, and then now the Detroit Red Wings hockey arena is opening next year. What they've done is the owner of Little Caesars also owns Detroit Red Wings and Detroit Tigers. He specifically made a deal with the city where he paid a larger amount of the cost, and they dropped all these stadiums right in these desolate areas, and it spurred this huge rush of condos and restaurants around each of the stadiums, and they've done it three times now with each of their sports stadiums, and it's bringing in all this suburban money, and it's also given a foothold for all these younger groups that are coming in, picking up a condo, opening a small business. And I think 10 years, 15 years from now, we'll look back on this as the single thing that changed Detroit.
Nathan, thank you. Andrew, I mean, is Detroit an outlier? Sounds like they had a beneficial economic outcome.
So, as I said at the beginning, I think the devil is in the details. And one of the things that's, of course, been going on in Detroit for several decades is that the city has been gutted and gutted as the automobile industry has moved out. And as the city has fallen economically, rents have gone down, and it becomes more and more attractive for nonprofits and artists and other lower income people to move in. Mm-hmm. And so if you can dedicate public money to any kind of construction, it's positive. And if you can as well create some emotional uplift by having professional sports teams, maybe that contributes to a process that was already underway.
Mm. Drew in Detroit, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, last caller took my point exactly.
Okay. All right.
And, I see it as terrible for the community, as we have a public school problem that is, it's just almost beyond repair at this point. And the fact that Illich is coming in and taking the taxpayers' money to go to an entertainment arena, there's no public good long term, I feel, that will bring the community together.
All right, Drew, thank you. Thanks very much. We're going to move on to another topic here, but Andrew and Ken, I want to end with ticket prices, because we took our kids to an NFL game recently, and boy, you need a second mortgage for these seats. It's already expensive. What's this all going to do to ticket sales? Ken Belson?
Well, I think you're seeing you're seeing in other parts of the economy, too. I mean, Broadway theaters here in New York, for instance, it's not cheap to get in anymore. And so I think you're seeing a different type of fan. I've noticed that here at New York stadiums, it used to be more of a lunch pail crowd watching baseball. It's much more of a family-oriented and perhaps more white-collar audience than it ever used to be. Mm.
Andrew, you see the same thing? Different kind of fan quickly?
Well, yes, for sure. But keep in mind that we're talking about 8 regular season games, 70,000 seats. That's 560,000 tickets you have to sell. It's easier for the NFL to do that than the NBA or MLB.
Got to go. Ken Belson, Andrew Zimbalist, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, what to expect from the NFL playoff games this weekend. This is On Point. And then there were four. This weekend, the Steelers face off against the Patriots for the AFC title. And after winning with a field goal in the last seconds of a game against the Cowboys, the Packers will go on to face the Falcons for the NFC title. What should we expect this weekend, and who will make it to the Super Bowl? Joining me from Laurel, Maryland, to talk about the NFL playoffs and our Super Bowl predictions is David Steele, senior writer for The Sporting News. David, great to have you. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me on, Jane.
So tell me, what are you thinking about this weekend? What do we have to look forward to?
You know, it's hard to look to it's great to look forward to this weekend, but it's hard to do that while forgetting about what happened last weekend.
Okay, we'll start there first.
I hope that everything is going to be as exciting as that Packers-Cowboys game was, that the Packers survived that against the team like the Cowboys, who had been the best in the NFC and who had so many dramatic storylines, so many young players who rose to the occasion the way they did, and the Packers were able to come out and still take that game in the fashion that they did. That adds so much drama and so much interest to the NFC game. The Packers are going to be playing in Atlanta. The Falcons have one of the great offenses in the NFL this year. They've got a most valuable player candidate in Matt Ryan. But the Packers have Aaron Rodgers, who conducted that final drive, connected on one of the great passes that we're ever going to see to keep that drive alive. They've now won 8 consecutive games. Rodgers had made a prediction right at the beginning of that streak that said, we're going to run the table. They have not lost since then. That was sometime in late November. And, they're as much as you can, they're sort of the Cinderella story of these playoffs, even though they have one of the great quarterbacks in the league and maybe in the league history in Aaron Rodgers. So that's the NFC game. And the AFC game is going to be, you know, two teams we're very familiar with, the Patriots and Steelers. They've been there a million times before, and whoever comes out of that is going to be, you know, sort of adding to their great, great, great legacy over the last couple of decades.
Might I just add that Packers-Cowboys game, people are going to be talking about that for a long time. Incredible game. Take us back last weekend. New England Patriots beat the Houston Texans. It was not easy. They gave them a run for their money.
They did, because the Texans have an outstanding defense. It's a top-notch defense there. Their offense really couldn't match what their defense could bring, and that's kind of been the Texans' story all year, and that's why they really weren't able to overcome the Patriots on what was kind of a flat, sort of an underwhelming day for the Patriots, really kind of not what they've been accustomed to being all year long. They had the best record in the entire league. They were 14-2. They did this even while missing Tom Brady for the first four games to that wonderful Deflategate suspension that I think we've spent.
Okay,
more
don't remind us.
Hours over the years.
You're in Boston. Okay.
Deflategate. What's that? Yeah, that'll add another element, of course, to this game. Obviously, for all the other great storylines and plots from that. The Steelers-Patriots matchup. If the Patriots go to the Super Bowl and they win the Super Bowl, they are going to be accepting the Lombardi Trophy from a guy named Roger Goodell, and that could be as much an interesting scenario and as much must-see TV as the game itself. So anybody who just likes the drama for drama's sake kind of wants to see the Patriots go there.
This is no cakewalk for the Patriots, though, David Steele. I mean, it's going to be tough beating those Steelers.
Very tough, very tough. I think when the playoffs began, when you were trying to identify teams that had the best chance of knocking the Patriots off, and the Patriots, not to take away from anything they've done, they play in a pretty soft division. The Steelers are really constructed to be the kind of team that could knock the Patriots off because of all the offensive ability they have, their past success. Mike Tomlin has proven to be a great coach. He's won a Super Bowl and has been to two of them. They've got just this incredible core of offensive players with Ben Roethlisberger and Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell. You know, they could give the Patriots a tough enough run that they're going to have to force the Patriots to dig as deep down as they have all year long to hold them off. Don't anybody be surprised if the Steelers come out on top on this. Mm.
The NFC Championship game then, of course, Green Bay Packers, Atlanta Falcons. Boy, that Aaron Rodgers, a phenomenal quarterback.
You know, you really literally cannot talk enough about Aaron Rodgers, honestly. I mean, we really could have spent this entire segment talking about what he has been able to do, not just during this winning streak of theirs, but also in the playoffs so far, particularly against the Cowboys. I mean, I would advise anybody to take a look one more time at that throw he made to Jared Cook, where he was on the run and Cook just barely got his toes in bounds, and it gave them just enough room to make the field goal to win the game. You know, a couple of breaks here or there, and we'd be watching the Cowboys this week right now. But Aaron Rodgers sort of willed them to victory, and this is the sort of thing he continues to do. And even though they're the underdog and they're playing on the road against, again, a great, great Atlanta team, you really cannot bet against Aaron Rodgers and feel very comfortable about it.
Quarterback Alex Smith for Atlanta. What do you see in that team?
Matt Ryan, he is the... He is having the season of his career. He's a guy who's been accused of being a little bit of an underachiever during the course of his career, not quite reaching, you know, reaching the heights in the playoffs that he has during the regular season. But the Falcons are the eighth highest scoring team in the history of the NFL. They've scored more points than all but seven teams in NFL history. They went off against a great Seattle defense with a few missing pieces, but they rolled it up on them last week as well, and that's a very, very, very hard thing to do. You know, can they do it again under a spotlight that they have not faced all year long? This is going to be a level of pressure and focus that they have never really had to deal with this particular group. This is where you find out how great a quarterback Matt Ryan is. If he wins under those circumstances and outshoots Aaron Rodgers,
yeah,
then, you know, he belongs in the conversation with the great quarterbacks in the league right now. So that's going to be a very fascinating thing to watch.
All right, give me your picks. Super Bowl, who's going to be there?
I think the Patriots will be able to outlast the Steelers. I think that the Aaron Rodgers train is going to continue to be unstoppable. So I'm picking New England and Green Bay to get to the Super Bowl.
And who's going to take it?
I think we're going to get that trophy presentation that we're talking
about. Oh, okay. All right. We shall see. David Steele, senior writer for the Sporting News. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.